The Dene have prophecies about the end of the world. Many come from a spiritual leader named Ea, who was known throughout the North in the late 19th century, and many of his prophecies have come true. One of Ea's visions foretold that every blade of grass will die, and people will have to leave their cities to look for water. They'll end up in Denendé, the land of the people, here in Canada's Northwest Territories, just below the Arctic Circle. In the vision, Denendé will be one of the last places on Earth with clean water and healthy fish. And you will know this prophecy is near when the stars begin falling from the sky. Maybe what Ea first saw is what happened in Denendé in the winter of 1978. It's a January morning in Snowdrift, a small community about 300 people on the eastern edge of Great Slave Lake. There's a cluster of little houses running down a gentle slope to the lake, which looks like a desert of snow. Fishermen are hunched over holes drilled 6 feet into the ice, waiting for the giant trout to take the bait. The air is still, except for the smoke rising from the clapboard teepees where the fish are hanging to dry. On one of the narrow snow-covered streets, a young language teacher named Celine Marlowe is walking to school. Celine's lived in Snowdrift her whole life. She teaches Denisu Tene, one of the languages of the Dene, who protect the waters of the Great Slave Lake. But we don't call it that.
The lake is Kunacha, the big lake. And if just the water, cool.
Later that morning, the children are sitting at their desks doing their lessons when there's a knock at the door. Celine's surprised. It's her husband, George.
George came to the school and said, all the kids have to go home.
Concerned and confused, Celine gathers the children and leads them outside. That's when she sees the strangers.
They were all over in town, I said. But all of them were all dressed in white, in a white suit, with their goggles on and gloves, everything. I didn't understand why they were all in this white suit. They were all walking around town with some beeping thing.
The kids follow close behind the alien-looking strangers. Every now and then, the white suits stop someone and scan them with their instruments. After a couple of hours, the strangers get back on their aircraft, which is still parked at the airstrip nearby. And then, they disappear into the sky.
That was it. Next day, I went back to work, and the kids were at school. Everybody's playing outside.
Hundreds of miles away, beyond the tree line, two Americans named John Mordhurst and Mike Mobley are running a dog sled team across this vast snowy tundra called the Barrens when they come across a huge pit in the snow. They stop the dogs and walk over. There's something jammed deep in the ice. It looks like caribou antlers. Could it be an animal stuck in the snow? But these antlers are all black and twisted. They look man-made, but there isn't anyone around for 100 miles or so. The ice around the unknown object is deformed, and the snow is tinted a weird gray color. When the pair get closer, they realize it's a huge chunk of metal with twisted rods sticking out. Mike reaches out and touches it.
We scratched our heads for a good long time, wondering, what the heck is this?
They get the dogs going again and race back to their cabin. A friend comes out to meet them.
As we were tethering the dogs up and we started to describe this piece of metal we found frozen in the ice, he gets kind of really animated and said, you found it, you found it. Mike and I kind of looked at each other like, what did we find? And he said, you found a Russian satellite.
The word Dene means people, and the Northwest Territories is the ancestral land of a few different Dene groups: Denisut Dene, Klitschko, Satu, Gwich'in, and Dacho. I'm Dacho Dene. Dacho means big river, and that's what we call the Mackenzie, which runs over 1,000 miles from the Great Slave Lake into the Arctic Ocean. Growing up on the shores of the river, a lot has happened that makes me wonder what condition people will find it in at the end of the world in Ea's prophecy. A lot of the fish are poisoned, animals have deformities, and there's a cancer epidemic. Many people will tell you that these changes are connected to what happened that winter in 1978, but nobody can say for sure. If there is a truth to be found, it's scattered in millions of pieces out on the land. Some have been eroded over the decades, others lost entirely. I decided it was time to gather what's left and try to put the story back together. I'm Dennis Enake Eko. From Imperative Entertainment in Vespucci, this is Operation Morning Light. Episode 1, White Suits.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
While the young Americans John and Mike are out on their dog sled trying to make sense of that chunk of twisted metal, Chris Normant and their fellow explorers back at the camp have also been noticing some weird things happening in the Barrens.
We'd seen this C-130 Hercules transport.
That's a military transport aircraft. It's like a hollowed-out jumbo jet with two propellers on each wing.
It just obviously wasn't a plane passing through. It was very low to the ground, it's huge, and it looked like it was flying in this very regular search pattern.
The Hercules is moving in a straight line, barely clearing the dunes of snow that cover the Barrens, then doing a 180 and tracking back on a parallel path, scanning the whole area. Inspired by the back-to-the-land movements of the 1970s, the six young Americans have turned away from the mechanistic society of the city to go on a years-long expedition to the north. At this point of the journey, they're spending the long, dark winter in Warden's Grove. It's a small, spruce-lined area on a river in the Thelon Game Sanctuary, which spans 20,000 square miles, its southern edge situated 300 miles from Yellowknife. That's the capital of the Northwest Territories and the closest city. The Thelon is filled with moose, wolves, wolverines, and grizzly bears. Every year, hundreds of thousands of caribou pour across the vast landscape, from their wintering areas down south to where they summer just north of the tree line. It would be easy for the Hercules crew to spot a foreign object against the white backdrop of snow, if it wasn't for the fact that the Thelon is bigger than Louisiana.
90% of the surrounding landscape is tundra, and most of that would have been just snow and ice with a few rock outcrops and like that.
Then one morning, a small plane lands near Warden's Grove, and representatives of the territorial government visit the Americans' camp. They look exhausted after their endless search of the tundra. That's when they tell Chris what everybody's looking for.
Cosmos 954 had disintegrated over the Northwest Territories, and, you know, nobody knew what was going on, basically.
It's a spy satellite that the Soviets launched a year before. But a few days ago, it disappeared from its orbit somewhere over the Northwest Territories. Did it burn up in the atmosphere? Did it hit the ground? Was it an accident, or did the Soviets do it on purpose? For now, nobody knows. It's 2 days later when John and Mike get back to the cabin with the news about the weird object in the snow. It seems insane that they found a chunk of a spy satellite in the middle of nowhere, but somehow it's the most plausible explanation they've got. They radio Environment Services back in Yellowknife.
We tell them, you know, we found a piece of this Cosmos 954, and there's a silence on the other end, right? Because everybody's looking for it, and there are these bozos out on the barrens.
At first, the environment officers on the other end think it's a prank. Their job is to monitor weather patterns, and this, slightly outside their wheelhouse. But eventually, they realize the Americans are dead serious.
They come back and say, well, don't go anywhere near this thing, you know? And then we say, well, John and Mike have touched it. That's when we get the standby, and then prepare to be picked up tomorrow. All of a sudden, there's the Twin Otter coming right down onto the tundra right in front of the cabin. And I remember these guys stepping out in these white radiation suits.
The pilot looked at us. He put his fingers up in a cross like, you know, stay back, you're infected.
And the Americans are just standing there thinking, infected with what? The group gets separated. Chris and the three others are evacuated to Yellowknife, but John and Mike, the ones who touched the object, they get flown out to Edmonton, a city that's 900 miles south.
It is starting to feel pretty surreal by this point in time. Here we are flying down to Edmonton, back into civilization, over this strange thing that had fallen out of nowhere.
It's the dead of night when John and Mike land at a base in Edmonton, where they're welcomed off the plane by the military. But someone else is there to meet them too, someone from the Atomic Energy Commission. And that's when they realize that the reason everyone is wearing white suits is that Cosmos 954 was a nuclear satellite. That weird object is radioactive. The military escorts John and Mike to a hospital to do some testing. They're scanned with Geiger counters before they can set foot inside. Everyone's nice, friendly even, but the Americans have been living on the land for months, and in the sterile environment of the hospital, they make an impression.
We are incubated in smoke. I mean, we smell like a campfire, you know. That would be the best smell. There are other smells there too, but
they're told to get undressed and into hospital gowns.
The poor nurses had to put our clothes into a bag. The way they picked them up was kind of, you know, so that they didn't hardly have to touch them.
The doctors run them through some tests and say they'll have the results in the morning. John turns in for the night.
I can remember looking out the window the middle of the night, the snow-covered city, drifts of snow along the roads, an occasional car driving along with its headlights on. Felt like I'd been picked up by a giant wave and carried along and just dropped someplace.
Meanwhile, up in Yellowknife, reporters are getting impatient. As soon as the satellite went down, news outlets from around the world dispatched journalists to Yellowknife to cover the search. But because the search mission has come up empty so far, the reporters don't have anything to report. When the press hears about the Americans, they think they finally have the story. They rush over to the airstrip to meet the explorers as soon as they land, but when Chris Normitt and the others disembark, the reporters realize they've got the wrong group. The ones they want are down in Edmonton. Instead, they end up interviewing a bunch of grumpy explorers who just got airlifted out of their expedition and into a media scrum. This is Chris on the night of their arrival.
We wanted to spend a winter as far removed from the, mechanistic society as possible. And here, against the most, the incredible odds, we are thrust right back into the middle of it.
The military will return them to the Warden's Grove camp, but not until the satellite has been recovered. That may be sometime this week. However, the center of activity now appears to have moved from Warden's Grove.
Days pass, and Chris can't really do much in Yellowknife but listen to the radio. That's how he first realizes that they're just minor characters in a much bigger story. Nuclear emergency teams have been deployed all around the Big Lake.
Today, the community of Snowdrift, 100 kilometers southwest of Fort Reliance, with a population of 90 persons, was also checked and found to be likewise free of contamination.
When you're from the north and you basically travel anywhere else, you'll usually get the same questions. People want to know what it's like. They want to know if you've seen a polar bear. They want to know if you live in an igloo. Everyone up here ends up with this kind of spiel that you keep in your back pocket just in case someone asks. One thing that's hard to capture without experiencing it firsthand is just how big this place is. It's an immense landscape dotted with small remote communities that are often inaccessible except by plane or boat. If you're out on the land, you could easily be 300 miles to the nearest settlement. And unless you know where to look, you're probably going to miss it. So even though there's this massive nuclear recovery mission underway, every reporter can't help but ask the Americans, what the hell were you doing out on the Barrens anyway? Chris's answer, it's really big.
I mean, the Northwest Territories, it was twice the size of Alaska and one-tenth of the population or something. And that sort of emptiness spoke to me in a real fundamental way.
In 1976, Chris, John, Mike, and three other friends decided to spend a year chasing that emptiness. The plan was to leave from Seattle, paddle thousands of miles from the Yukon to the Northwest Territories, then spend the winter in the Barrens.
All of us were attracted to the idea of, having a great adventure, right? We were in our 20s and had various degrees of testosterone poisoning at the time.
But they weren't the first explorers to suffer from this affliction. They were following in the footsteps of an English adventurer named John Hornby, who wintered in the Barrens at the turn of the century. And the story of Hornby is worth telling, if for no other reason than as a cautionary tale about how badly things can go when you don't understand the land. John Hornby was born to a wealthy family in 1880, came to the Arctic as a young man, and of course, he fell in love with that emptiness. He'd spend the rest of his life exploring the tundra, but there was something reckless and fatalistic about his passion for the North. Here's Chris.
He didn't plan well. He just would go off with very little preparation, let's say very little food, and sort of count on caribou, muskox, whatever, to keep him fed. And, did these kind of amazing trips in some way, but they involved a lot of suffering and living under conditions that we would just consider horrific. There's this kind of weird nobility, and at the same time, you're thinking, this is really crazy.
Hornby was 46 years old in 1926 when he invited his 18-year-old cousin Edgar Christian and another guy to join him for the winter in the Barrens. They built a cabin in the Thelon, and they were counting on the caribou migration for food. The herds came every winter, and they were so massive, it'd be like shooting fish in a barrel. But not that winter. Around the cabin, for miles in every direction, there was just the emptiness. The herd never came. Eventually, the men began to starve. They started scrounging through the snow for discarded bits of leather, anything they can chew on to trick their bodies into survival. The third man died first, then Hornby, and finally young Edgar gave in. When people came looking for them in the spring, they found the wasted bodies and a note. It was in Edgar's handwriting. It said, "Look in the stove." They opened it up and found a book. It turned out that Edgar had kept a diary all through the winter of 1926. It records the agonizing process of starvation, your body not being able to produce enough heat against the 50 below weather, and the horror of watching others die around you. The diary was published under the title Unflinching and became required reading for schoolboys as a testament to the stubborn strength of the British spirit, which is one way of looking at it. Anyway, one of the young Americans finds the book, loves the story, and decides to do the same trip, hopefully with a different ending. One thing working in their favor is that Hornby never got to be a travel influencer. In exchange for a magazine feature, the Americans get an endorsement from National Geographic. The sponsorships start pouring in.
We got canoes, skis, and other outdoor equipment. We got tents, sleeping bags, and parkas. We got a donation of a case of Jack Daniels and a case of Southern Comfort. Very kind of those people.
Of course, it takes more than good equipment and a couple of cases of whiskey to keep a man alive. Once they're in the wilderness, the Americans find themselves slashing through rivers of hard white water with razor-sharp rocks below. It's a steep learning curve. John describes paddling with his canoe partner, Gary, another member of the six-man crew.
We were not up to the whitewater task as far as skills go. It was Gary and I that were providing the excitement for everybody.
They capsize a bunch of times, and each time they have to swim against these powerful currents to the shore, fish their stuff out of the water, and dry it out.
On Gary's birthday, it was a memorable day because we dumped three separate times.
When they're not in the water, they're carrying 100-pound packs and 75-pound canoes through the bush for days. But after traveling for months, they finally reach the shores of the Great Slave Lake. It's summer 1977. They exchange their small fleet of canoes for a long north canoe that can fit all the men and their provisions. But if you want to get to the Barrens, you got to cross the lake. I feel like I really don't need to explain why I hate the name Great Slave Lake. But if we must, the name dates back to the 1800s when the Dene were at war with the Cree, a rival indigenous nation to the south. We're cool now, but back then, French colonial fur traders used the Crees as guides to the region. Their aim was simple: get furs from skilled trappers and send them back to Europe. And the Cree described us as the ones they made slaves out of in the course of doing battle. The French started calling my people slavey, and our lake became the Great Slave Lake. I prefer the Denisou-Kené name, Tunéde, or the Big Waters, because that's what it is. It's about 10,000 square miles. It's the deepest body of water in North America. There isn't a building on the continent that you couldn't drown in that lake. To the people here, Tunéde is at the heart of our lives. Our communities grow on its shores. We drink from it and sustain ourselves on its fish. The lake connects us to each other. It doesn't represent captivity or ownership. It's our freedom. For Celine Marlowe, the language teacher in Snowdrift, the lake finds a way to be totally new every day.
In the morning I get up, boy, it's so beautiful. Just nice and calm. You could hear the loons crying. Oh, it's so beautiful. So peaceful.
On the other hand, Tunéde is not a placid lake. The winds can change without warning, and suddenly, you'll be looking at 6-foot rolling waves, When you grow up here, you learn to read the water. You understand that it's bigger than you, and that makes you humble. When the American expedition reaches Tuneda in the summer of 77, they have to make a choice. Take a longer, safer route that'll get you to the next place in a few weeks, or paddle like hell across an open stretch of water and hope you live to tell the tale.
We certainly knew we were exposing ourselves to a dangerous situation if the wind came up.
But after months spent basically living in a boat and hauling gear, the Americans are tired. They decide to go for it. The water starts to get rough. Waves are smashing the sides of the canoe. They're paddling like crazy to get across this opening when one of the crew, a guy named Robert, starts telling the story of the Count of Monte Cristo. It's about a man who escapes his wrongful imprisonment to take revenge on his captors.
We all got glued to our seats listening to Robert tell this breathtaking story while we were in this breathtaking, dangerous situation. Well, we did make it across. We didn't capsize. We got to the other side. We were all really tired and thankful, thinking we'd really escaped a close one there. But the first thing we wanted Robert to do is to finish telling the story.
They've arrived on the eastern arm of the lake. Then they paddle another couple of weeks northeast, the tree line slowly getting thinner, until they're in the open tundra of the Barrens. They find a derelict cabin in Warden's Grove, the roof caved in from a wolverine that came looking for food. And they decide to spend the winter there, running their six-dog sled over the Barrens and admiring this world of ice. Until the day they find that weird metal object sticking out of the river, and everything changes. After they get evacuated to Edmonton and tested for radiation, John and Mike spend a long, sleepless night waiting for the results. If the thing they touched is radioactive, how radioactive was it? Soviet satellite schematics are highly classified, and in that vacuum, rumors will fly.
It's dangerous. It's radioactive. If you happen to sleep on a small little piece of this radioactive stuff, you could be dead in the morning.
Suddenly, a knock on the door. Turns out, it was just a few x-rays worth of radiation. They got lucky. But the doctor still looks like he has something on his mind. John asks what's going on.
I guess the media was really putting a lot of pressure on the military to find stuff. Like, why haven't you found it? They said, it's time for our morning news conference. The press has really been giving us a hard time because we haven't really found anything. Would you guys mind being the stars of this news conference?
They give John and Mike their smelly clothes back and push them out in front of the flashing lights of the press corps. John spooked, so Mike steps in to tell their story.
We found snow that was corn, very crystal snow, so that when he stepped on it, it crunched. So we knew something hot was underneath, and it bubbled it up.
Finally, something the press can run with.
The debris is emitting moderate radiation, but a night of checks in an Edmonton hospital determined that the men suffered no ill effects.
But that doesn't mean there aren't ill effects to uncover. A few days later, two American military men and a pilot are out searching for craters in a Twin Huey helicopter when they spot something in the ice. The chopper lands in a swirl of snow and the men hop out in their white protective suits. Unfortunately, the crater's natural, definitely not a piece of Cosmos 954. So, they take off for Fort Reliance, a small settlement of just 10 people on the northeast tip of the lake. The flight will bring them just a few miles from Snowdrift, so they change course to take a look at it. A few days ago, when Celine let the kids out of school, the search teams were using detectors designed to measure the fallout from nuclear explosions, and they announced that the community was clean of all contaminants. But this time around, they have more sensitive equipment. The men approach Snowdrift, which looks like a mighty metropolis against the endless white expanse. Suddenly, the detectors are going crazy. They're getting hits all over the place. It doesn't make sense. Snowdrift is supposed to be clean. They land outside the settlement in an area people use for ice fishing. The white suits jump out and start frantically scanning the ground. The school teacher, Celine Marlowe, watches the strangers from her window.
They were picking something up in front of my place, I said. They were even looking on the ice over here, too. They were picking up stuff there, too.
What they expected was to land in Snowdrift and find big chunks of the satellite, just like the young Americans, or at least pieces. But now, they realize that the satellite is actually scattered across the snow in flakes. Some of them are so small you can barely even see them. And those flakes are radioactive.
And nobody said anything what it was. Nobody ever said there was that satellite fell down.
The people of Snowdrift have no idea that a star has fallen from the sky. That's next time. Operation Morning Light is a production of Imperative Entertainment in Vespucci and is hosted by me, Denizan Nake-Kohn. I wrote it with Michael Lapointe. For Imperative Entertainment, the executive producer is Jason Hoke. For Vespucci, the executive producers are Daniel Turkin, Johnny Galvin, and Michael Lapointe. The series producer is Aliyah Pabani. The story editor is Matt Willis. Thomas Curry is the managing producer. Audio mix and sound design by Alice Boyd. Our closing theme is Cigare Dante by Digga Wolf off his album Inni Spirit. And this episode was recorded at his studio, Knockout Productions.
Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.